This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking to Dr. Julie Peekman about her book titled Liberty in London, Sex in the 18th Century Metropolis, published by Reaction. As you might expect from the title, the book investigates what's happening in terms of sex, sex lives, and what involvement women have in this from, you know, the long 18th century, which is an incredibly helpful investigation because it takes us behind a lot of the kind of myths we might have in popular culture about kind of who was a prostitute and what was that like. So, Julie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about the real history of this time and place.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Julie Peekman, as you said. I'm a historian and a fellow at Birkbeck University. I've been working on the history of sexuality now for at least 25 years, probably nearer 30. I've examined quite a few books on the subject of 18th century pornography, six volumes of Hoare's memoirs, History of Sexual Perversion, which is a book on sexual, what we'd call sexual differences now, and global sexualities. And you can find all this on my website at www.juliepeekman.co.uk. I also write for academic journals and national newspapers and popular magazines, such as Who Do You Think You Are magazine, the BBC History. And also I do contribute to television documentaries for channels such as Channel 4, BBC, Biography Channel, and most recently I've worked on a program called Wooden Kites for the History Channel and a program for History Hit entitled Georgian Pleasures, Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll. I'm now looking for producers to take on my new project, which is on Liberty in London, Women and Sex in the 18th Century.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. That very much gives us a great context to start with. Thinking of the book kind of in the big picture, before we get into the details, could you walk us through the time period that the book covers, the long 18th century, and how you chose the start and end dates for this?
Right, well, Liberty in London covers the long 18th century, which is roughly 1680 to 1830. I wanted to include the Georgians. And I first started getting interested in prostitution and the history in my first degree. But this was a Victorian women. And by the time I took my MA, I was focusing on 18th century women as little research had been done on them. I wanted to look not just at prostitutes, but the position of women who'd had sex outside of marriage and how they were denigrated and basically verbally abused for indulging in sex, for love, desire, or behaviour that men might display with no sexual diminution to them. So it's the sort of misogyny and the overriding double standard which made women's lives a misery that I really wanted to investigate. And I wanted to dig beyond the usual tropes of jolly, bawdy London and to reveal these underlying and deep-seated attacks on the so-called libertine women. And show how they were manipulated in certain roles and the limitations that were placed on these women who had sex outside of marriage, which forced them into using their sexuality to secure a place for themselves in life. And that would apply to whatever the station the women had been born into. And I suppose what we'd now call rape culture was insidious in this society, more so in London, of course, which is why I chose to study the capital. So really, I just wanted to explore how these women had to make up their own set of rules to deal with these limitations that were placed on them, and the roles that they were forced into, and how they developed their own ruses to deal with it. And in spite of all the verbal and physical attacks, they fought back using their own, their wit and their guile and anything they'd got to survive in a man's world.
That's definitely a fascinating research topic, and it makes sense in that context, the years. So thank you for taking us through that. Staying in the big picture, can we talk about literally the first word of this whole thing, the first word of the title, libertine? What did this term mean during this time period? And to what extent was it a different meaning if it was attached to a man versus a woman?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because this is something that's always bugged me. The term libertine was very widespread in the 18th century, but it was also often used in the 17th century to describe a certain type of upper class man who was sexually free with his behaviour. It's defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as a person, especially a man, who freely indulges in sexual pleasure without regard to moral principles. It was really a word that was bandied around to describe the sexual freedom and philosophical free thinking of French aristocratic men in the ancient regime. All writers of pornographic novels such as Crébillon, Diderot, La Closse and de Sade, but it was also common usage in England by the 18th century. The world libertine did include women, the whole idea of libertine women differed greatly from their male counterparts. And this was, their sexual freedom was also often connected to sexual desire, but less so to sexual encounters they needed to survive. And of course, women in this situation in the 18th century, who'd been forced into a position of perhaps making a living from the sex trade, they didn't always receive the pleasure from their sexual experience that men did. It was often just a way of making a living. Others, of course, might wallow in the sexual pleasure, and we've read about this in some of the memoirs that I spoke about earlier. They might very well follow their heart's desire and give everything to the men they love. But this still made them dependent on men and kept women still lost their freedom. So although libertine women were often free sexually from the moral conventional codes, their libertinism did come at a price for them. And we can see a vast gap opening up when the term liberty was applied to men and to women. Whereas libertine men were considered genial rakes and it didn't affect their reputation too much, libertine women were seen as immoral. And this sexual laxity, which in men was a proof of their manhood and virility, was condemned in women. And usually these women who'd indulge or been called sexually incontinent were actually always had derogatory terms applied to them, such as whores, harlots, or strumpets. And women working in the sex industry were often called libertines, various contemporary commentators would write tracts on them denouncing them. So therefore, if we look at libertine, it's quite an imprecise and ambiguous word, and we shouldn't be applied to women that likely actually means something quite different to women when applied to women. Men's sexual activities were obviously given much more license, and this was we encounter a full blossoming sexual culture after the Restoration. The male libertine was largely unconstrained, and to a large extent, these men were let off the hook as regards any sort of sexual conduct outside of marriage. Unless it was a reputable woman, of course, and or with another man. And that's when men would come under scrutiny. Mm. So for the idea for libertinism for men, which had started in the youth as possibly sowing their own, their wild oats, as we call it now, for young women, it invariably meant a ruined reputation and ostracization from respectable society.
Mm. No, a very different application indeed. So thank you for illuminating that for us. I'd like to ask you to tell us a bit more about women who did work in the sex trade. Can you tell us a bit about kind of what kinds of women undertook this work and to what extent it was sort of something that once you were in that sort of work, you stayed there, or was it something more transient?
All kinds of women turned to prostitution to make a living. Some more successful than others. Throughout their lives, the status might change. They might start off as courtesans or whores of fashion and end up as street walkers as their looks faded and they became less popular. Or they might start off as street workers and work their way up to become courtesans, which indeed some women did. Others who came from a background of poverty might start off as streetwalkers and never make any development from that position. And of course, these were the women who were at the lowest station in the sex trade. And their job was to pick up men on the streets or in public places. The women also might work in back alleys or the streets of the back streets or taverns. And some had dismal lodgings where they'd take men back for sex. But generally speaking, we can see, when we've examined prostitution, that it was a transient profession for some women who weaved in and out of the trade depending on the work available elsewhere. And for example, seasonal employment meant women fell on hard times when the harvest was over or when a theatre closed after a season, or simply when work dried up for them. And then they may take up prostitution on a spasmodic basis. But some of the work opportunities for single women were, of course, few and far between. But there were jobs in the dress trade, as milliners and mantua makers. But indeed, these women who made items of women's clothing were also particularly known for their sidelining prostitution, or for fixing men up with other women. But we can see domestic service was very often seen as responsible for forcing many young girls onto the streets, because once they lost their jobs, obviously they also lost their homes. And so it was very often recognised that domestic service, because of its precarious position, meant that female servants were often turned out of the master's house. Say their son seduced or molested them, and once this the female servant fell out of favour with their employers, they wouldn't get a reference and were left in an extremely vulnerable position. But in this book, I cover all sorts of women who might be seen as libertine women, not just prostitutes, but also I cover adulteresses and actresses as well, such as Peg Woffington.
Thank you for explaining all of that. I think we don't necessarily link some of these factors, like what work was available with what the gaps were, how that might change seasonally. So it's very helpful to see the pieces all come together. Thinking about kind of then once the women are in undertaking sex work, or whether permanently or not being prostitutes, what was the kind of reaction from the police from this? What role did the police play when it came to prostitution in this time and place?
Well, at this period, the policing of prostitution in London was quite uneven and spasmodic, and it was reliant on a mixture of watchmen, beadles and constables. There's no central system of policing in existence, so each parish was really left very much to its own devices. An Act of Parliament, for example, in 1735 allowed for the appointment of paid watchmen in certain areas such as St George's in Hanover Square. And this was fairly typical, that it hired 38 watchmen, 4 beadles and a watch house keeper. And we saw a series of further watch acts virtually in every parish in London, who'd established their own watch patrol by the end of the century. So it's constables who were responsible for the watch, and they possessed the power to arrest any criminals, including vagrants and the idle and disorderly, which was the category that prostitution fell into. Indeed, the constables had powers to arrest anybody who was offended loosely defined sets of behaviours. That this would include any vagrants, prostitutes, and disorderly persons. The charges what I found is the charges applied to these prostitutes were often quite broad and vague, and it ranged from vagrancy to lewd or disorderly behaviour, or simply being a lewd woman. And an example of that I'll give is Mary Dixon was, in quotes, charged on oath for being the lewd woman and for being picked up by a gentleman in the street late last night, and could give no account of herself or her lawful way of living and have no legal settlement, but in a common vagrant. So in other words, you know, there wasn't a really strict definition. So the police, you know, had a fairly free hand.
What happened then to those women who were picked up by the police and sent to prison?
Well, if a prostitute was discovered, her punishment was to be paraded around the town in a horse-drawn cart and placed in a pillory where she might be pelted with garbage. However, if it was a first misdemeanor, she might just be given a small fine. When they continued, they were more like and caught again, they're more likely to be sent to Bridewell prison for a stint of hard labour, possibly hacking hemp like we've seen in Hogarth's depiction in A Harlot's Progress. And of course, poor whores with fewer means to pay fines couldn't escape a sentence or bribe themselves to get off the hook. Prostitutes were also subjected to public floggings, and the women were stripped to the waist and whipped. But this became less common from about 1770s onwards and was eventually abolished altogether in 1817. And of course, once inside the prison, prisons were dreadfully unhygienic, with no place to wash and just filthy straw to sleep on. And usually you'd get covered in lice, and there was cockroaches and rats all over the place. And this, of course, was why typhus was rampant. And if you actually ended up in one of these jails, you might end up with typhus. So the only way out, really, was to pay a good bribe. And you might get better, for a hefty sum, you might get some better lodgings.
Not a great situation to be in that situation. No, but thank you for describing it. Speaking of lodgings and sort of living conditions, what were brothels like in London at this point? And how did local and national government, as you mentioned, police kind of had a lot of leeway, how did local authorities react to brothels?
London brothels were obviously flourishing in the 18th century, and they offered all sorts of services, and so much so that they became a major problem for the local authorities. Some of the most salubrious sex establishments existed around Mayfair, and they were aimed at the high end of the market, where titled men and wealthy businessmen would pay over the odds for the most desirable women. But in turn, you'd have more chance of picking your own better class of clientele there. And at the lower end of the market, they were often run by boards clapped out from their own days on the town, and they offered the more the poor whores who were struggling to keep themselves alive, and very often paid a pittance, but at least they had some kind of protection and a roof over their heads. The public generally hated boards as they were responsible for corrupting young girls, and the authorities were keen to shut down boarding houses, which were the most disruptive, but they weren't particularly effective. There's cases where the church, when church wardens and overseers became concerned about certain sexual anarchy on the doorstep, they'd call meetings to discuss how to suppress the brothels, particularly around Covent Garden. But little was done in the long run, as the following century, the same area would be found clogged back to back with taverns, inns and bawdy houses, all running illicit sex for sale. But the authorities seem more keen on shutting down homosexual brothels, and most of our listeners will probably be knowledgeable about Mother Clapp, who ran a homosexual brothel, and she was in Field Lane in Holborn, and she was ordered to stand in the pillory in Smithfield and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
That is quite a raucous, I suppose, picture painted there. So thank you for taking us through that sort of environment. I'd love to maybe pick up a bit on what you were saying earlier in terms of the long time period and the different aspects of the 18th century that you talk about in the book. Could you maybe help us understand how the image of the prostitute, given how prevalent it was with the answers you've just described, how the image of the prostitute changed over the time period you cover in the book? And why do you think it changed in these ways?
Sure. It changed. The image of the prostitute changed over the 18th century. And the prevalent idea, which had been established early, the idea of the brazen whore, gradually gave way to that of the seduced maiden. Although you do see that sometimes these images would run concurrently. Unmarried women who'd had sex were no longer necessarily seen as insatiable vixens any longer, but rather as prey who'd been targeted by lascivious men. And these men were seen to have taken advantage of vulnerable women. So women in prostitution were not necessarily any longer considered as lewd harlots who'd enticed men into sex, but were seen as more of victims of circumstances, really. And the reason for that was probably because there was a softening of sentiment towards young women who'd been seduced. And it led to a greater understanding of the different reasons why women ended up in prostitution. And we can see by the middle of the second half of the 18th century, the image of the woman as victim was entrenched in novels such as Samuel Richardson's Clarissa. And the idea also permeated in men's magazines like The Rambler, who were starting to talk about the need to rescue prostitutes. So the idea was permeating society in general as well. And this can be seen in the founding of the first Magdalene Hospital for penitent prostitutes in London in 1758, and the formulation of the belief that prostitutes could be rescued from vice. The person who set that up was Robert Dingley, who was the director of the Bank of England, together with a chap called Jonas Hannaway, who was the commissioner of the Victualling Office. And they established what they saw as a safe retreat for prostitutes, where they might be rescued rather than sending them to a house of correction, or prison, which was what had happened previously. And they believed that many of the women had turned to prostitution because of men's failures and men's rape or seduction rather than any choice of their own. There was also the philanthropist Jonas Hannaway, who'd set up the Magdalene Hospital, wrote a tract called The Thoughts on the Plan for Magdalene House. And he suggested these women were not necessarily from the labouring poor, but the daughters of poor tradesmen put into domestic service. So again, we see the idea coming out that these women probably started off respectable. And this was something that was attractive to the middling sort and the gentry. So people would back these institutions and the idea of rescuing women so that they could go into the hospitals. But they did, in fact, were seen to fail, mainly because of the structure of the hospitals and that there was sort of hierarchy that was established in the institution. also women were not given the support once they came out, so fell back into prostitution as the only way that they knew how to make a living. So I think that was one of the reasons that the whole of the idea of how women had got into prostitution was shifting, and people were becoming more aware of the plight of women who'd been seduced or raped or somehow been debauched by men unwillingly.
No, that's a really interesting change. Thank you for explaining it to us. Speaking of being aware of women engaged in sex work, courtesans are a pretty big thing during this period, very much celebrities in ways that we might even recognize today. Why was it that this sort of courtesan celebrity culture happened, do you think, at this time and this place?
I think a lot of it was to do with the fact that they could now get a much higher profile. Changes in technology had allowed for mass printing and circulation of news, and courtesans were at the centre of this new emerging cult of celebrity. The public were calling for lots of more information as they heard about courtesans and their love affairs and revelations about the scandalous behaviour. So just like now, people wanted to read about what was happening to people's sex lives. And readers clamoured for domestic details as well, both their not just the public lives, but the private lives as well. So any nuggets they could find on them, particularly sexually intimate details, were reported in these gentlemen's magazines or in small tracts of pamphlets. Even their daily activities became fodder for gossip columns, and this would come out in newspapers and pamphlets, ladies' magazines, and even the full-length books I talked about, the horse memoirs, which were very often not exactly true stories of the women's lives, but had added titillating fictional anecdotes just for the prurient readers. And so this increased visibility of courtesans and actresses meant that they sort of became public property, and a person's private life was no longer safe. The libertine women who made a name for themselves, either from their beauty or reputation, became the centre of this public attention. And the masses just developed a fascination with them. And the distinction between good and bad celebrities was quite blurred, because they just became glorified figures in certain public areas. And the other thing that added to this was that portraits that had been made became available in print. So people like Reynolds, who painted Kitty Fisher, who was one of the leading courtesans of her day, that painting was made into a mezzotint and was available in all shops all over London. So it's a bit like Madonna having her a face on girls' magazines and that sort of thing. And Hogarth painted Lavinia Fenton as Polly Peachum when she was playing in the Vegas Opera. And that had become increasingly popular. And of course, that there was lots and lots of copies made of it, so people could buy it and worship Lavinia Fenton as their new heroine. So yeah, it was a combination of technology and printing, which made images of these women much more available.
No, that makes sense. It's all coming together at this moment. I'd love to ask you about something that we've mentioned a few times, but I think kind of deserves a bit more investigation. Can you tell us about the ways in which sexual violence and sexual harassment varied based on class at this point?
Sure. Obviously, the lower down the social class you were, the more likely you were to be open to harassment and threats of sexual violence. And this was because you were more prone. Poorer people were more, they had to go out to try and find a living, and women were more in public spaces than richer women. And streetwalkers, particularly walking out in public places, like streetwalkers at night, when they were out, they were obviously quite vulnerable, and the threat of rape was ever present. Streetwalkers might gain some protection by going out in pairs, but invariably they had to peel off when they picked up a client, which again made them more vulnerable. And different classes of women obviously would expect, therefore, different levels of harassment, and the outcomes of prosecution would also vary depending on a woman's status. And coming back to servants, they were also at risk of being raped inside the house of their employees by the men who employed them, be it the master of the house or his sons. And of course, young girls were particularly vulnerable. There's one case that I've investigated, which is a young girl, 16-year-old Sarah Bishop. She'd been in London for about 3 years, and she felt she was out of place. That was the quote that she said, "I felt out of place." And she was given, she was obviously vulnerable to the people who passed her by. And she was given employment as a servant by George Carter. And he waited until his wife had gone to bed and then raped the girl. And the case came to trial. And if a case did come to trial, and there were many reasons why they didn't, many of these young girls couldn't really describe what was happening to them, as they didn't have the language to express themselves. And of course, also the problem of finance was taking a case to court in the first place was very often too difficult for a poor woman. So obviously, the higher up the scale, the more money you'd have to bring a case against you. But even then, there'd be more harm to your reputation. So it was a sort of double blind situation for them.
No, very much a tricky position to be in. Speaking of the challenges of negotiating contrasting kind of requirements of behaviour and social expectations, I did want to ask a bit about attitudes in this period around male homosexuality. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but can you maybe tell us a bit more about the extent to which and maybe why attitudes change over the period of your book regarding men who seek sexual activity with other men?
Yes, in the book I argued from about 1660 to approximately 1830, I found that there was a distinct change of attitude to how many men were treated regarding their inclination for sex with boys or young men, or indeed with adult men. Increasingly, men had to protect their image of masculinity and evade accusations of effeminacy that was being bandied about them. And this meant an increasing protective balance that they had to obtain between their public and private personas. I examined courtier John Harvey, William Beckford and Lord Byron and compared them. And they're worlds apart because John Harvey was early 18th century, William Beckford was centre, and Lord Byron at the early 19th century. So they were a good example of how to look at how things had changed. So even though Harvey was a royal courtier in the early 18th century, and he was regarded as effeminate and a possible homosexual, he didn't actually come under much attack. He married and he kept his own counsel and kept his affairs with Stephen Fox quite discreet. And so he was more or less left alone because he wasn't blatant about his homosexuality. It might well have been suspected, but it tended to be ignored unless there was a political reason to pull a person down. Those who had exhibited homosexual leanings were fine to indulge themselves without too much harm to coming to them. And another example of that is the Earl of Rochester. There was a possibility of being shunned at court, of course, but the threat of prison didn't seem to have raised too much anxiety for either Rochester or Harvey. However, by the time of Byron, the persecution of homosexuals had become the norm, and it was now necessary to cover up homosexual activities with much greater care. Given Byron's extremes of personality, as well as his passion for women, he used and manipulated his image and used his vibrant personality to show himself to be a Lothario, and that would cover his tracks as a pederast. Was he did go off to Greece, he then could indulge in his love affairs with young boys quite easily, as there was less it was less problematic there. It was less in evidence. There's definitely a change in how men were treated, and there's much more antagonism towards homosexuality by the end of the century and the early 19th century.
Yet another really interesting change that you trace and examine over the course of the book. So thank you for adding that one on to our conversation and kind of getting right up to the 19th century, right up to kind of the end of the time period. So I really just have one final question. You mentioned at the very beginning that you've got a lot of projects that you work on, really interesting areas, not just in obviously writing. This book is very new. Is there anything you're looking to work on next or also working on that you'd like to preview?
I'm mainly turning my Libertine London into a TV series. That's what I'm looking for a producer at the moment who would take this kind of project on. So any interested producers, please feel free to contact my agent. I'm also working on finding an appropriate place for the book launch, the launch of the book. I want to obviously want to celebrate the launch. I'm writing newspapers and magazine articles based on the new book, for various magazines. And if people want to check out what I have done before, please do look at my website. But I'm also doing one more thing that I'm trying to fit in. This is going to take years, I think, is I'm working on a musical based on my biography of a woman called Peg Plunkett, who was an 18th century Dublin brothel keeper, an astounding woman who wrote her memoirs. So that's the other thing that I'm...
Amazing.
That's a moment. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And anyone who's fascinated by all of this and wants all the details, the book is titled Libertine London, Sex in the 18th Century Metropolis, published by Reaction. Julie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Miranda. I very much appreciate it.